Hey friends, this is Andy Storch, and I'm excited to announce that we are bringing the Talent Development Think Tank Conference back on February 22nd and 23rd in Sonoma, California. Yes, you might remember we hosted this conference for the first time in January 2020, and it was a huge hit with everyone telling us it was the best conference they ever attended. And of course, we were looking forward to running it again in 2021 until the pandemic hit. That's when I launched the Talent Development Think Tank membership community, and that's been going strong since May of 2020. But I know how valuable it is to get people together in person, and that's why we are excited to be bringing the conference back again on February 22nd and 23rd in Sonoma, California. I'm committed to making this a highly engaging and interactive event where you can connect, learn, and grow together with other talent development professionals. This is going to be the best event out there in talent development, and I would love to see you there. If you want to find more information and get your tickets today, the website is tdtt.us/conference. That's tdtt.us/conference. I hope to see you there. Welcome to the Talent Development Hot Seat, a show where I interview business executives, talent development professionals, and thought leaders to find out what has been successful and challenging in the world of talent development. My objective is to share ideas, valuable lessons, tools, advice, and trends. My hope is that all of this will ultimately help you, the listener, expand your knowledge, grow your career, and accelerate your success as a talent development professional. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Talent Development Hot Seat. I'm your host, Andy Storch, and I'm just starting this episode with a quick note about what you're going to hear. This episode is a little bit different than what I normally publish because it is the first time I'm publishing an episode with someone who is not a talent development professional, but one that I still think would be valuable to you as the listener. And this interview is with author Gay Hendricks. And if you have not heard of Gay Hendricks, he has authored over 30 books. He's been around for a long time, appeared on over 500 radio and television shows. And I discovered him when I read the book, The Big Leap, not that long ago, and made some changes and just learned a lot from him in that book. I thought it was really fascinating. In the book, he talks about discovering your zone of genius, which is something that you're really good at and you enjoy, in which, you know, time flows. He also talks about something called the upper limit belief. Your upper limit problem, which is something people run into when they gain some success in some areas and then disrupt their life in others, or sabotage their lives in others, or run into different limiting beliefs. And I originally reached out to him and asked him to do this interview with the intention of publishing it on my other podcast, The Entrepreneur Hot Seat, which I still will do. But I thought that it might be useful for this podcast as well. And again, like I said, Gay does not work in the talent development field, but he is a psychologist for over 45 years. And I believe that a lot of the things that he talks about both in his books and in this interview will be useful to leaders across any field, especially in talent development, where you're working with other leaders and trying to help them with different things. So I thought that, you know, you as a listener, being probably someone working in talent development, would still enjoy this interview and hearing Dr. Gay Hendricks talk about his life and his work. And so with that, I will let you hear it. I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Gay Hendricks. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Andy Storch, and I am so grateful that you are joining me today for a conversation with Dr. Gay Hendricks. And Gay Hendricks has been a leader in the fields of relationship transformation and body-mind transformation for more than 45 years. After earning his PhD from Stanford in 1974, Gay served as professor of counseling psychology at the University of Colorado for 21 years. He has written more than 40 books, including bestsellers such as Five Wishes, The Big Leap, Conscious Loving, and The New Conscious Loving Ever After. The last two were co-authored with his wife of more than 35 years, Dr. Kathleen Hendricks. He is also a mystery novelist with a series of 5 books featuring the Tibetan Buddhist private detective Tenzing Norgay. And most recently, he has launched a new mystery series featuring a Victorian-era London detective, Sir Errol Hyde. And as we're recording this, we are on video, and I'm looking at Gay, and he has a giant bookshelf behind him of books that were all written by him. Pretty impressive. He's also appeared on more than 500 radio and television shows, including Oprah, CNN, CNBC, 48 Hours, and now this podcast. Gay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Andy. Nice to be with you.
It is absolutely an honor to have you on. I first came across you when I heard about your book, The Big Leap, and I bought it and put off reading it for a while. And then when I finally did, it kind of hit me over the head like a ton of bricks. And this is some stuff that I just really needed to hear about limiting beliefs and your upper limited beliefs, finding your zone of genius, and some things on relationships that I found really valuable. And so I want to get into some of that stuff. But I also think your background and your story is really intriguing. So I'd love to start with that, if you don't mind. Share a little bit of your origin story and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I grew up in Leesburg, Florida. I was a third generation Floridian. My grandparents moved to Florida around the turn of the last century, so around 1900 or so. And then my mom was born in 1911. And she grew up eventually to be the mayor of Leesburg, Florida, where she was born and where I was born. And so we have a long tradition in Florida, although I ended up marrying a Yankee and moved off up into the great north and then ultimately west. My wife is from California, and so we kind of had a feeling we would eventually move out here. And back about 1995, we moved out here to California to be near her parents also, who were getting up in years, and we wanted to look after them. And so after they passed away around 2005, we moved over here to our current town. We live in a little mountain valley called the Ojai Valley, spelled O-J-A-I. And I happen to think it's paradise on earth. I've been around the world 30 some times now. And this is a place I'm proud and happy to call home. Very creative, wonderful place to live. And it used to be a spiritual gathering place for Native Americans way back a couple of centuries ago. There's still a lot of pottery you find here and things like that from way back in that area. So it was a place of pilgrimage, and it has that feel to it. So, but I'm have been both an entrepreneur and a writer full time since way back, because I wrote my first book and published it in 1975. And right after that, I started entrepreneuring my own seminars and workshops. I found that, as you probably found as an entrepreneur, you can do a whole lot better setting up things yourself than you can parceling out your time for other people.
Yeah, and you have a lot more control anyway.
Yeah, and I've always kind of been an entrepreneur at heart. Even when I was a kid, I always had some little business going. I remember one of my first businesses was selling eggs to neighbors. And I would carry around a bag of a dozen eggs, and I forget what they cost. I think it was either 50 cents or 60 cents at a time for a dozen eggs. And then a while, lawn mowing business for a while. And then my big coup was watermelons, though. I would buy watermelons for, in those days, you could buy an entire watermelon in the height of watermelon season in Florida for like 10 or 15 cents. And so what I would do is I would buy a whole watermelon and then slice it up into pieces and stand by the side of the road holding up a piece of cold watermelon, you know, and people would just whoosh, 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 they'd be driving right in. And so those are some of my first experiences. And to this day, we've had the Hendricks Institute now since 1989. And my wife mostly runs that. She's kind of the brains of the gang as far as being able to read spreadsheets and handle bookkeepers and personnel things and that kind of thing. So I do a lot of the big picture stuff, and she and a team of people are in the other room right now. I'm back in my home office, and she's in there with a team of a couple of people doing stuff. And so we kind of have our company that kind of runs out of here, but we also have an office that I very seldom get to, because I've kind of established my comfort zone and my zone of genius here in this room. So I do a lot of my interviews now on Skype and Zoom.
Oh, that's really cool.
If you work in talent development, you know that your job has become more important than ever. The problem is there's so much uncertainty and noise out in the business world, and things are changing so fast, it's hard to know where to go and what tools and resources to use to solve your problems. That's why I recently launched the Talent Development Think Tank community as a central and safe place to access information, ask questions, and talk with other L&D professionals like you so that you can achieve your goals and accelerate your career. Join today to get instant access to our online platform and community of ambitious, helpful talent development professionals who understand your world and can help you solve your problems. Right now, I'm offering 25% off the subscription price to podcast listeners. Just go to talentdevelopmentthinktank.com and use code HOTSEAT for 25% off. That's talentdevelopmentthinktank.com and use code HOTSEAT. Thanks, and on to the episode.
Such a great background. I remember you talked in your book, The Big Leap, about your entrepreneurial roots, selling watermelons by the side of the road, and that sort of discovery that, hey, if you chop it up and make it easy for people to consume, they'll pay a lot more money for it, which is, that's sort of like the basics of entrepreneurship, right, in business, that you take something you buy at wholesale, you parse it out into something that people really want to buy and package it how they want to buy it, and they'll pay more money, and hopefully it adds up to a lot more than what you paid for it.
Well, yeah, because I forgot to tell you that part of the story. I had to change my business model, and it was actually a marketing coup that saved the business, because at first I took four watermelons down to the side of the road, and my thought was, okay, I'll buy them for 15 cents, which I did, and then I'll carry them down and I'll sell them for a quarter. And if I sell out, I've got 40 cents, you know, and that looked like big stuff to me. I had to carry all four of the watermelons back up the hill at the end of the day because I didn't sell any of them. And so then I figured out, okay, I'll chop them into eight pieces, charge a nickel each. And by golly, that's 40 cents a watermelon. So now I'm taking home gigantic sums.
Right.
And so that was the breakthrough, the marketing breakthrough that saved my watermelon business. But I'll tell you, if you want to go in the watermelon business, you got to be willing to stand in the Florida sun all day. And that's kind of the downside of it, because get to be about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
You've been out there in the brutal sun all day. So it has its challenges.
I was going to say, I grew up in Central Florida as well. And you mentioned lawn mowing. I also did a lot of that in high school because there's no shortage of need for that because the grass grows so quickly. But it takes some strength and stamina to stand out there in the Florida heat and humidity in the middle of July and August and September, mowing lawns and doing stuff. When I was 15, my mom made me go work for the highway maintenance crew for the summer. And that's when I learned that I did not want to do, you know, manual labor for a living, and that I definitely needed to go to college and get into some white collar work.
Well, you and I had the same mom then, because my mom put me on a construction crew when I was, I can't remember if I was in the 11th. Yeah, I was in the 11th, between the 11th grade and the 12th grade. And I was the only like high school kid on this crew of really grizzled veterans.
Same here. Yeah.
Come in and say, oh boy, you know, old Dewey got shot last weekend, you know, in a drunken brawl. And, you know, they'd be talking about stuff that made my hair stand on end. But it was good training. It made me really want to go to college.
Yeah, same here. Exactly. Now, I mean, they had already been hammering in me that I needed to go to college. And then after I did that, I absolutely knew. Speaking of going to college and intellectual academic pursuits, I know from reading your book, you also knew from a very early age that you wanted to get into psychology. So how did you discover that?
Well, the story that's told about me, which is I can sort of remember it, but I remember one part of it, that it was raining the day I got my first tricycle. And I got it for my birthday, which is always January 20th is when my birthday is. So it was January 20th in Florida. I was 4 or 5 years old, probably four actually. And I started pestering my grandma to let me ride my tricycle in the living room. She had this huge living room. And because I couldn't go outside, it was my birthday and I really wanted to ride my tricycle, but it was raining and I couldn't go outside. And so finally my grandma, who was the most wonderful, loving woman, although very straight-laced and stern, she let me ride my trike for once inside in the living room. And the first thing I did was, after riding it around a few times, is I put a box over in the corner and I made it my office. And I would commute to my office on my tricycle and park my tricycle outside. And then I would climb into the cardboard box, and there I would be in my office. And what I did in my office, in my imagination, was people came to me and gave me problems to solve, and I helped them solve it. And I was clear. I told people in my family that I didn't don't come to me with any physical problems. That's not the kind of problems I handle. I'm a different kind of doctor. And they would see, this was a town that did not have a psychiatrist or a psychologist or anything remotely resembling this. So they actually sincerely asked me, well, what kind of a doctor would it be then? And I said, well, it's the kind of doctor that talks to you about basically problems of living, you know, and they thought that was the funniest thing, that here was this little kid sitting in a cardboard box willing to counsel people on problems of living. And so anyway, that was a big, big joke remained in my family. And up until my teenage years, people would rib me about it, you know, like, are you sitting in your box today? And
right.
thing, or have you commuted into town on your tricycle yet? And so they gave me endless ribbing about it. So, but I think each of us, I mean, to be serious for a moment, each of us has within us what I call a spark of genius. And it doesn't matter if it's a spark of genius at writing a great symphony or making a great soup. What it is you have something in you that has the capacity to surprise you and has the capacity to surprise others. And I think it's up to us in our life to go after that, to find that, to nurture that spark of genius and to bring it forth. And that's what really the Big Leap is all about. Because I'll tell you, I'm up in my 70s. I started in my field when I was in my 20s. And so 1968, so I my math skills are limited, but whatever 1968 to 2018 in. So that's about 50 years, isn't it?
50 years, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so for the past 50 years, when I saw my first client in 1968, big strapping football player guy named Gary, who was afraid of snakes, interestingly enough. He was this big, strong guy, but anytime he saw pictures of snakes in a magazine, he'd freak out. And it was causing him problems because his girlfriend and he would go to movies and would be fine until the snake appeared. And then here this big 6'6", 240-pound guy would turn into a kind of a whimpering mass. And so I helped him move through that issue. And that hooked me for life. On what turns me on to this day, 50 years later, is that look on people's faces when they shift from one state of consciousness to another. They shift from one reality, the reality of limitation, to the reality of, oh, creative possibility. Oh, I see what I could do. And boy, I'll tell you, from a, you know, the kid that drove his tricycle, that's what I think I was after then. But even now, on the other end of my life, I can still say it's the very best juicy thing you can do in life, is assist another person or have a breakthrough yourself to a new reality of possibility.
Yeah, well, let's get into that, because you talk in the book, The Big Leap, about really the importance of finding that zone of genius and trying to operate in your zone of genius, because it's the thing that you're the best at, you enjoy, you'll be happy all the time. You know, time moves really at whatever speed you want it to at that point. But I think a lot of people probably have the question, how do you find that? How do I discover my spark of genius or zone of genius?
Okay, so fasten your seatbelts, because it's so simple but so powerful that almost nobody takes me up on my invitation to do it. But when I go and consult with a CEO of a corporation, sometimes I come in and I'll work with some person for a day about a particular issue. And I spend all day with them. And they have to pay a lot of money for that. But whether I'm working with that person who's paying me a lot of money for it, or some person sitting next to me in an airplane seat that's asking me stuff for free, I'm always going to be after helping them have a breakthrough to their creativity. And when they ask my advice on how to do it, I say, here's the way to find your genius. Today or tomorrow, but pencil it into your calendar, 10 minutes. I want you to go in a room by yourself for 10 minutes and do nothing but wonder about, what is my genius? What is my genius? And I want you to say that sentence out loud, and I want you to say it in your mind, but don't bother to do anything else. You know, you might get off on a different chain of thoughts. That's okay. But come back to that. Use it like a mantra. What is my genius? Next, I give them the assignment. You can get this in The Big Leap, but this is the advice I give right here in my office, whether it's a CEO or some high school senior who's got a glitch of some kind. It's to ask yourself, what do I most love to do? Again, it's it's worth going in a room for 10 minutes and just, what do I most love to do? What do I most love to do? So spend 10 minutes wondering, pure wonder about it. Nobody who's ever done that has ever come back to me and told me it didn't work. It works. It's just, it's so powerful that most people won't get around to doing it. There's a great philosopher of several hundred years ago who said, Blaise Pascal was his name, French philosopher. And he said that all of humankind's troubles stem from the inability to sit in a room by ourselves for 10 minutes doing nothing. So I want people to go in a room by themselves for 10 minutes, but I want you to do something. I want you to cultivate wonder, because wonder is the gateway to creativity. In one of Einstein's notebooks, Andy, there's a passage about a question in theoretical physics that he wondered about every day for 27 years.
This episode of the Talent Development Hot Seat is sponsored by Advantage Performance Group. Advantage is the first place to call when you need leaders to lead, sellers to sell, and your business to flourish. We specialize in connecting companies with exceptional learning solutions to help them turn strategy into action and get their people doing the best work of their lives. We're also providing tons of great content on a weekly basis. In fact, we recently launched a great webinar series that has been going on weekly with content such as Creating a Culture of Multipliers, Gender Equity, Liz Weissman's webinar on Helping Rid the World of Bad Bosses. We have a new webinar from Brent Snow on decision making. We have a webinar on multipliers and how to use multipliers during troubled times, calming the storm. We have a webinar from our partner, Julie Winkle Giulioni, on developing in place, how to continue your growth during remote working, and a webinar from Paul Middleton on the secret sauce for learning in the flow of work, plus many more. Just head to our website at advantageperformance.com, click on free resources, and you'll find the link to webinars and all of our other insights and resources there. Thanks for listening, and now back to the show.
He wondered about it for 27 years. You know, he just pondered it in his mind. To me, that's absolutely stunning, because most people don't wonder for 10 seconds about whether they want to go to McDonald's or Burger King. You know, that they it's sacred territory is wonder, because it opens you up to this new world of creativity.
Yeah, and this day and age, we expect answers so fast too, with that, you know, forgetting that there's distractions all around. But if we wonder something, I'm going to pull out Wikipedia and look it up right away. Then it'll give myself a chance to really think through things, ponder, wonder, and come up with that. My follow-up question that I know others have as well is, let's say you do discover what that zone of genius is. You know, for instance, I think I know what mine is, but it's not immediately profitable, or maybe you don't think it's realistic to do it full time as a business. It may be great as a hobby. For instance, I have a business, a main business that I enjoy and that I'm good at, but I think my true zone of genius is really in talking to people, building relationships, doing interviews like this. But this is not a profitable endeavor. This is just something fun that I'm doing to share value and knowledge with the world. How do I convert that so that I can spend more of my time in my zone of genius?
Well, there's two thoughts I have about that. One is to build it up in increments. That you, at this stage of the game, you probably don't want to spend 48 hours a week doing podcasts. You know, you want to have a certain particular amount of time you go into it. Yeah. And then put a priority, of course, if you so desire, on monetizing your podcast, or monetizing it in some way by selling something else off it, your consulting or whatever. So, you know, to put an hour or two or three a week in it is a good investment. I say people can prosper by spending first only 10 minutes a day in their zone of genius. And also another thought occurs to me too, that, yeah, I see I built it up from my 10%. I started out where I was spending less than 10% in my zone of genius. I now don't refer to zone so much as I call it a genius spiral. Oh, by the way, I should mention that the sequel to The Big Leap, which I've been working on for many years, is coming out in September. And awesome. So I'll be sure to come back and tell you about that when it comes out. It's called The Joy of Genius. And it just went on sale for pre-order on Amazon a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I can't wait.
Is going crazy on the charts already. So, nice. But the actual book will be out on September 25th. We're coinciding the publication to be on my wife's birthday.
Excellent. Oh, that's great. So you talk about building this up incrementally, and I think it's important for people to remember that. It's in this day and age, especially with what people share on social media, it's so easy to look at even someone like you and say, look, he's spending all of his time in his zone of genius. It's amazing. I wish I could do that. And forgetting the fact that you're in your 70s, you've been building this up over many years and learning and discovering and growing and changing, and all of us are, and it didn't just happen overnight.
No, it came actually, you know, it comes through a series of choices, because I can even remember way back in graduate school when I was about to get my PhD, and a lot of my people that were in the program, all they wanted to do was go into private practice because that was where the money was. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of my professors saying, are you heading toward private practice or do you want to be a university professor? And I said, well, I'm definitely on the university professor track. But I'll tell you a secret. The main reason I want to be a university professor is so I can have my summers to write. And I said, that's the best thing I can do. I'm a pretty good teacher. I'm not a great teacher, but I know I can do a good job at a university. But I really want to use it as a vehicle for writing, and because that was my passion. And so I didn't know there wasn't any such thing as pop psychology at the time where you could go on Oprah or on a podcast or...
Right.
Anything like that. It was only a couple of different channels, but I knew I didn't want to trap myself in an office for 45 hours a week. And even though my friends that did that were driving Mercedes and I was still clunking around in my old VW, I still really appreciated my life choice, because with every one of those summers, I wrote a new book. And so gradually they took on a life of their own that was much larger than anything that I was getting through the university.
Yeah, I remember you talked about in The Big Leap, this sort of the dichotomy between the private practice and the professor track, and how the grass is always greener for one over the other, right? Because the private practice psychologists were making a lot more money, but they were working all the time and had no time, or perceived that they had no time to work on that book. Whereas the university professors had all that time, but they were jealous of the others for making more money. And I think this is something that can be true in almost all different walks of life, where we have a choice, right, to take on a profession that is going to make us more money, but we know we're going to have to work 60, 70 hours a week and barely have time to spend with our family, let alone pursue a passion or a hobby, versus maybe taking that easier, lower paying job and spending time cultivating that zone of genius, those other things we want to do.
I can remember my first academic job was $13,000 a year in 1974 at the University of Colorado. And at the time I had a friend who was in private practice, and he was making this grandiose sum at the time of $70,000 or $80,000 a year. But I remember chiding him on something, because I called him once to talk to him about something at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I said, beautiful day, isn't it? And he said, oh, is it? You know, he'd been in his office like from 7 a.m. seeing one client after the other. Right. And so that became the mantra when I would tease him. I was, oh, is it?
Oh, is it? Yeah. Well, so speaking of that, you know, you had more time to work on some of those passion projects, and those people may not have. And I wanted to ask you about time. And in particular, in the book, The Big Leap, you talk about this idea of Einstein time, where you theorize that people really have all the time they need to do what they want. And it's really kind of a shift in mindset. I wonder if you could explain that. And then I have a follow-up question for you about it.
What I call Einstein time is when you're doing what you most love to do, you enter an expanded type of consciousness where time becomes your friend. You have enough time to do what you really want to do. If you ask most people, they'll say they don't have enough time to do what they really want to do, but they've got it backwards. And in other words, they're waiting for time to do the stuff. And I'm saying, even if you only do the stuff for 10 minutes a day, whatever your genius is, if you start putting 10 minutes into it, that's going to lead to 20, to 30, to 40, and time will expand to accommodate your genius. Time expands to support our genius. So the more you spend time in your genius, the more time you will have to spend time in your genius. But if you try to do it the other way around, if you wait for the time to do your genius, I always say there's never enough time to do the things you really don't want to do anyway.
That's interesting. Does that kind of become the opposite or the answer to Parkinson's law, which typically says that work will fill to the time that you have allotted for it? So if you have an hour booked to do something, even if you could do it in 10 minutes, it'll take you an hour. And this seems to be sort of like the opposite, where you're saying time will expand to the work that you want to get done when you're in your zone of genius.
I brought to mind, as you were saying that, Andy, a funny memory of one summer way back to support my writing habit, when I was, before I got my university job and all that, I worked in a public liquor, in the state of Maine, they only sell liquor through state stores. You can't go to a private liquor store. And I worked in one of those government liquor stores, which was odd at the time because I didn't drink. Finally, in my 30s and 40s, I cultivated a little taste for wine and beer, but still not a big drinker. But anyway, at the time, I didn't drink alcohol, but I worked in this liquor store all summer because there was so little to do that I got to spend a lot of my time writing in the back room. And the first day on the job, one of our jobs was to take down all of the, you had to put a card in when you sold a bottle of liquor. So we had to bring down all these cards and then enter them on this big list. This was way before computers. And the first day, they assigned me to a section of the store. And I did it in about, maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes max. And I came back and asked the manager, well, what do I do next? And he said, oh, man, you want to take it a little easier. You know, you're going to make the other guys feel bad because they were all taking 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes to do this. And so I had the same experience, or talked to a friend who one summer worked for the post office department. And he came back at noon. He'd run his whole route. And the postmaster said, hey, man, you're going to make everybody look bad. Take it a little easier out there. So I think there's a lot of that that goes on in the world. But the real essence of the problem is that we haven't been coached to go looking for our genius, that what we most love to do, that people, when they begin to really focus in on that, suddenly the time begins to grow that they're able to spend time doing it. And that, to me, is a beautiful thing. That's a new kind of physics, I think. It's kind of like the same thing that, you know, they talk a lot about positive thinking. There are a lot of books about positive thinking. But I've just found in my own mind, like I remember a person asking me once for the first time, what do you want? What do you really want to accomplish in your life? And I never really thought about that. But once I actually sat down for a few minutes and thought about what I really wanted to accomplish for my life, it became much, much easier than to just go for it, because it's a lot better to do that than going through life kind of, you know, battering around from place to place.
Yeah. So, right. And when would you say that relates to when you get into that zone of genius, or you know what you really want to do and you're connecting things back to what you really want out of life, you want your goals, you get into sort of that flow state where time almost kind of stands still as you're getting things done. But the flip side of that is, I think people would push back and say, well, you might get lost in that and time passes and then you become late to other things, or you run out of time to do other things. And I love what you said in the book about how people blame their schedule and they blame time, because it's so true. And I catch other people doing that now, myself too, but especially other people saying, well, I don't have time for this. And I will push back now and say, well, you actually have time to do whatever you want. It's just about your priorities and what you choose. But I think some people might push back and say, listen, we all have the same amount of time. I have these responsibilities. I have to get them done. How can you say that I have all the time I need?
It has a lot to do with priorities, because, for example, when I was growing up, I heard a lot of people complaining about never having enough time to do what they really wanted to do. But I noticed that those same people would spend the entire evening drinking a bottle of vodka and smoking a pack of Camel cigarettes. You know, so that was the priority over whatever it was they wanted to do. And so I think that one of the key skills in life is learning to prioritize your creativity so that it's very high, so you treat it as sacred space. Because I believe it is inside ourselves. What makes us most fully human is our ability to hatch new ideas and to come up with new ways of doing things and new ways of solving problems. And to me, creativity is kind of the glory of being a human being, is that we get to think up a new solution, know, just look at what we've accomplished in the past 150 years. When my grandparents were first living in Florida, you know, they all got malaria because of the mosquitoes. And when I was growing up in Florida in the very same town, sometimes in the very same house, I didn't get malaria because by then science had come along and done some things. And the same thing, you know, 115 years ago, the infant mortality rate was 50%. Half of the children died. It still is in many places in the world. But now in a good bit of the world, we've taken that down to a very small fraction. And so I celebrate our creativity in being able to do things like eradicate polio. And see, I think that if we can do that sort of thing, we can re-engineer ourselves so that we don't need to go having a war every 15 or 20 or 25 years or having a depression every 30 or 40 years. You know, so I think we can engineer some better ways to deal with problems that seem unsolvable now.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a place to connect with colleagues and peers from your industry and find out what other people in talent development are working on, you need to check out the brand new Talent Development Think Tank membership community. Inside, we have members from companies all over the world who are working on all different things in talent development and sharing what's been working, what's been not working, and answering each other's questions so we can all get our jobs done more effectively and be more successful in our careers. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to have you. Just head on over to tdtt.us/community, and you can use code HOTSEAT for 25% off your subscription. That's tdtt.us/community and use code HOTSEAT for a limited time for 25% off your subscription. If you have any questions, reach out to me and let me know, and we'll see you there.
All those solutions came from people spending time thinking, pondering, getting creative, testing things. And but the interesting thing about as time goes on and the modern technology we have now, modern society, there are so many distractions that are taking people's time. And people say, well, I don't have enough time to do X or Y. I don't have enough time to focus on my fitness or spend time in my zone of genius, or I can't take 15 minutes out of my day to just think. But then as you point out, what else are they spending their time on, right? Well, how are they prioritizing their time? And it could be really important that they do prioritize their time to spend time on that. The last thing I wanted to ask you about is you talk about upper limit beliefs a lot, or upper limit beliefs and how people run into those. And especially, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the problems that people create in relationships, right? And having arguments and sabotaging their relationship. And I think I've experienced that myself many times. I've been married for 14 years. I have two kids, and there are plenty of opportunities for that, right? But one of the things you mention is the importance of having that, quote, 10-minute sweaty conversation, right, that is uncomfortable and could maybe save you a lot of time later. So hard for people to do. I wonder if you could just explain the importance of that and why, and the benefits.
Well, in my new book, The Joy of Genius, which isn't out yet, it's a sequel to The Big Leap. It'll be out soon, later on in the fall of 2018. I tell a story about in my pre-Katie days. We've been together almost 40 years now, but in my unenlightened days before I met Katie, my wife now, of 39 years, I had a relationship with a woman named, that I called Nora in the book. And she had her father was a traveling salesman when she was growing up and was always having affairs. And so it kind of wrecked her childhood. And so she had a big thing about it. Like if she saw me talking to somebody else at a party, she would get upset. And so she had a very big sensitivity about that. Well, one time I went away to speak at a conference, and I had a one-night stand with another woman who was presenting a seminar at the conference. And so I came back, and I avoided the 10-minute sweaty conversation with Nora until finally, it took a month or so, I felt more and more uncomfortable that I had this secret that I was carrying around. And so finally, I just told her one day. And she told me to get out. I thought she would say thank you.
Yeah, she wasn't too appreciative of that.
Thank you for your honesty. Yeah. That was one of my life lessons I learned that day, that people always don't jump for joy when you tell them the truth. But another thing I learned was that there's an incredible, even though she gave me a tongue lashing and told me to get out of her apartment, when I told her, I felt also a sense of liberation and freedom because I had spoken the truth of something that had been clogged in me for a month or so. And, you know, finally that relationship kind of wound down, but that taught me a big life lesson that when at all possible, tell the truth about something within seconds of it. Don't wait a month, because I remember that month of just feeling like this little pebble in me started growing till it was the size of a bowling ball and just felt like I was carrying this burden. But the moment I released it, even though it probably ended the relationship, it still was this incredible And so that one of the things we talk about in our work is what we call living in a state of completion, where there's nothing you haven't said that's important to another person, there's nothing you haven't listened to that's important, and that you're willing to listen to whatever another person has to say. And that allows you not to carry a lot of excess baggage from every conversation.
Yeah, that is, it's so important and so hard to do. But I experienced this, a very small example of this just about a week ago, where my wife and I got in an argument on a Sunday afternoon, and it was really bothering me. I don't think it was really bothering her, but it was really bothering me for the rest of Sunday evening and into Monday morning. And I think in the past, I might have just let that go, but I've learned so much from your book and some others that, you know, it's really important to have that conversation. So I brought it up and said, you know, I'm just feeling upset about the argument we had. And first of all, her reaction was, "What argument?" So she hadn't been holding it in like I had. And I told her, and then, you know, she apologized and we talked things through, and I felt so much better after that. And I had a great day because we had that conversation. But I think that's just, we often avoid those difficult conversations. And I try to make sure that all that stuff is on the table now. Like you talked about the state of completion with her, with my business partner, with clients that I work with. There's not anything that we're holding back or withholding. We're not keeping secrets, because it's just going to cause so much stress and anxiety inside of us. So important. So thinking about, as we go to wrap things up, entrepreneurs that may be starting a business or running their own business or part of an organization, given what you have learned over the decades and what you teach in this book, what's one more piece of important advice that you think is important for people to remember as they are starting to grow and maybe achieve more success, but also running into challenges along the way as well?
Carve out a little bit of sacred space time for yourself, whether it's 10 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour every day, that you can focus on cultivating your genius. The more you do that, the better life will work all around. I've never seen an exception to that. And so the more you dedicate yourself to your own creativity, the more it facilitates the creativity of people around you. And that's ultimately, to me, well, my life purpose that I developed in 1977, which I still have, which is, I expand in love, creativity, and abundance every day as I inspire others to do the same. And to me, that's life at its best.
I was going to say that if you didn't. I have a list of daily affirmations that I read every morning, and yours is, that mantra is right on there, that I say it every single morning now, because it perfectly fits how I want to live my life, which is to fulfill my own true potential and also inspire others to do the same. And that's one of the reasons why I have this podcast and love connecting with people like you who are doing the same thing, and just love everything that you're doing, Gay, and just really appreciate you coming on this podcast. For anybody listening that wants to go find out more about you, get your books, possibly get in contact, where's the best place for them to go?
Probably the easiest place is just to go to our basic website. We have a bunch of different websites, but the basic one, Hendricks.com, HENDRICKS.com. And that's kind of a good jumping off place to our other things. Like, we have a whole website called HeartsInHarmony.com, where people can get our e-courses and home learning materials. So either HeartsInHarmony or Hendricks.com.
Got it. All right. We'll make sure to put a link to that in the show notes. And as we were recording this, I went and already pre-ordered your new book, which is coming out in September. I can't wait to check that out. And we'll put a link to that as well. And we'll maybe have to have you back on to talk about that new book when that's out, because I think it sounds like there's a lot more practical advice in there as far as living your zone of genius. So Gay Hendricks, thank you so much for making time to come on the podcast today and sharing some of your experience, your knowledge and wisdom. I really appreciate it. And I think that our listeners do as well.
All right. From another Florida boy to another Florida boy.
Yes, sir. All right. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Talent Development Hot Seat. If you got value out of this show, please subscribe, leave a review, and share with your colleagues and friends. We want to spread the word and add as much value to the talent development community as possible, and we need your help. As always, you can find more information and connect with me at talentdevelopmenthotseat.com. Take care.